Six.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania was one of the states that opted out of the government expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett's Healthy Pennsylvania is his proposal to expand health insurance for the state's 500,000 low-income residents using the private health care market. His plan requires that some recipients pay a premium for their insurance, and several mispayments would result in termination of coverage. There are incentives for work and for healthy behavior. There's also a hearing on Healthy Pennsylvania scheduled for tomorrow, I'm assuming weather permitting. Well, today on Radio Times, will the Obama administration give the Corbett plan a waiver? And I guess only time will tell. In the meantime, our guests are Judith Solomon, Vice President for Health Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, joins us from their studio in Washington, D.C. And Judith Solomon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Nathan Benefield. He's Director of Policy Analysis for the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives, and that's an organization located in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Nathan Benefield, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And let me begin with you, Nathan, because Governor Corbett has called Medicaid a severely flawed entitlement program, and this Healthy Pennsylvania is his idea to fix it. Do you see it as a severely flawed entitlement program?
Yeah. The current Medicaid program, it's a broken system, and that's, you know, part of the Healthy Pennsylvania is addressing reforms in the current program. People don't realize this, but it, if you look at all of state funding and the federal funds that the state spends on it, it basically takes up 30% of our state budget, about $20 billion in state and federal dollars. And that those costs are growing faster than the rest of the economy, and growing faster than people's incomes, which obviously over the long run it's not sustainable. But it also delivers poor quality care to recipients, that one in three doctors won't take Medicaid patients. It reimburses doctors less than traditional and private insurance. Even Medicare reimburses doctors more. A lot of doctors won't take it, and those on Medicaid have longer wait times and often worse health outcomes. So we certainly agree with the idea that you need to reform the current entitlement program.
And I want to pick up on that, but let me give you a chance, Judith Solomon, to weigh in on Medicaid. How do you see this program?
Well, I would see it pretty much the opposite of what he just said. It is an extremely successful program that provides the foundation of health care for millions of Americans, including seniors, people with disabilities, kids. And most of the studies show that, in fact, I would say all the studies show that it does provide care. It is certainly better than being uninsured. For children in particular, it has been shown that the care they get is equal to the care of insured patients, privately insured patients, and that's the same for adults as well. So expanding Medicaid is certainly the right thing to do to cover the almost 300,000 Pennsylvanians who are now in the coverage gap because the state has not expanded.
Let me give you a chance to come back on that, Nathan. And then I do want to pick apart or tease apart some of what Governor Corbett is proposing.
Yeah, I mean, on one part, there's you know, in terms of the outcomes, there are a lot of studies that show Medicaid patients have longer wait times. When you look at especially like cancer patients having much longer wait times and worse results than those on private insurance. The other thing, talking about the gap, you know, part of what Medicaid does is it actually crowds out private insurance. And a lot of the people who would be eligible for Medicaid are actually currently covered in private insurance. And what is likely to happen is you're going to see people dropping private coverage to shift to Medicaid, which is, you know, free to them, but taxpayer-subsidized program, which is actually worse, for, you know, going to cost taxpayers more, but also is a you know, worse coverage for those who are being pushed into Medicaid.
And Judith, broadly, we're speaking, talking about Governor Corbett's Healthy Pennsylvania. Is the idea is to use some of these this Medicare expansion, but to use it in the private insurance market. What's your response to that sort of overall idea?
Well, that idea is being used in several states already. It has just been approved in Arkansas, also in Iowa, to put the newly eligible people into the new private exchange plans. So that is certainly something that can move forward. But there's other features of his plans that are not that is not likely to be approved, including premiums for very, very low-income people. And getting back to what Nathan just said about crowd out, what we're really talking about now in Pennsylvania is for adults, Medicaid just covers parents of kids who are eligible with income up to 33% of the poverty line. And, you know, for a single individual, the poverty line is about just under $12,000. So we're talking about extremely low income. And people who don't have a dependent child are not covered at all. So these are very, very low income people we're talking about. Many of them are working, but they're working in jobs that don't provide health coverage. So I don't think it is. We're talking about, you know, 281,000 people, according to the Kaiser, uninsured people today who are in this coverage gap. And we call it the coverage gap because people with incomes above this the poverty line can be covered in the new exchanges through the health plans there with subsidies up to four times the poverty line. So it's the people under the poverty line who are really left out in the cold.
Well, Nathan, let me pick up on an example that I read a lot about, and this is a part of that some recipients would be charged a premium for their coverage, the idea of getting some kind of skin in the game. At least supporters say that. What I read is it could be as much as $13 a month, even if someone earns as little as $479 a month. I did the math. That's $136 a year. Probably not a lot for a lot of people. But if you're only making $5,748, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, but I think it is important to look at premiums as a way to make sure everyone does have skin in the game, make sure they understand the costs of what they're getting. But also, what's important to have a sliding scale so that those premiums, increase as income increases. Mm-hmm. Basically, what we would like to see, to redesign a healthcare system from scratch, would be to have a sliding scale assistance so that those with higher incomes start moving off of government assistance and into the private market.
Don't we have that to some degree?
Not much. I mean, with current Medicaid, I mean, it's almost you're either in the program or you're not in the program, and that when you hit that cutoff point, it can be dramatic. It's almost a cliff of when you lose eligibility for Medicaid as well as for other welfare programs and assistance programs, which I think when you talk about the income levels, you should look. You also consider the other benefits that are available to those in that income bracket that are available for food stamps and for other benefits.
But you think $13 a month for someone that makes $479 a month that seems fair to you?
I think it's not totally unreasonable. I mean, I think there's room for debate over what that level should be, what the premium level should be. But in general, I'm in support of the idea of having premium assistance.
What's your take on premiums, Judith?
Well, I think we know from a strong base of research that as income goes down, the ability to pay premiums and the in healthcare programs goes down as well, and participation decreases. And it's really important, I think, to put this all in the context of the Affordable Care Act and how the Medicaid expansion is a part of the goal of finding a pathway to coverage for everyone. Now, the people with income above the poverty line in the exchange can be charged premiums at 2% of income. What Governor Corbett is actually proposing is even higher than that for people at, as you said, very, very low incomes, 50% of the poverty line. It's actually about 3% of their income. And because we know, a Medicaid waiver is supposed to demonstrate something. Calling it a waiver is really a misnomer. The waiver is the mechanism. It's the fact that you can waive provisions of the Medicaid statute. And here we're talking about a provision that says people will not be charged premiums. But you do that because you're going to demonstrate something. And we already know that premiums depress participation. And in a new system where everyone is supposed to have coverage, creating some barriers right at the start is just not the way to go. And I think we know already from the experience of Iowa that the federal government is not going to allow Pennsylvania to charge people with incomes below the poverty line premiums that will result in loss of coverage if they don't pay them. So it's a real non-starter at this point. And, while we certainly applaud the intent to move forward and expand Medicaid and get coverage to those adults who are in the coverage gap, I think it is a non-starter in terms of the premium part of the proposal, as well as the work search as well.
But are you saying, Judith, that the idea of skin in the game, at least as it applies to low-income individuals or families, is essentially a barrier?
Yeah, I mean, premiums are a barrier for someone who has so little money and has to have a place to live and buy clothes and food for their kids and so on. It just becomes really, really hard for many people to afford them. And that's what we've seen by a number of studies that actually can show, predict participation levels based on the level of premiums and the incomes of the people. And there's a landmark study that does that and shows that the participation decreases dramatically. So in a system where we're supposedly creating a pathway to coverage for everyone, setting up a system that we know is going to be a barrier to participation for many low-income people is just inconsistent with the goals of the Affordable Care Act.
Let me give you a chance to respond to that, Nathan.
Well, I think I think Judith and I have different goals of what success looks like, and the idea that enrolling more people into government programs, making them dependent on government, is not the outcome we want, and simply having what's quote unquote coverage. Is not necessarily the idea. We want to make sure people have access to high-quality health care. In many cases, giving them an insurance card, a Medicaid card, doesn't guarantee that they have good quality access to care. And certainly, with the pressures on Medicaid spending at the state level and at the federal level, with federal deficits, there's more opportunities to even cut what Medicaid pays doctors even further, which would reduce the quality of care. And that's even, the one part of what we've been supportive of work requirements and premiums. Part of the Medicaid health EPA would reduce some of the payments that Medicaid gives to Medicaid care organizations to pay for services, which was actually going to hurt a lot of those people on Medicaid.
But how? And we're almost having a break here. But how does this plan though improve health care for low income individuals?
It really doesn't. I mean, I would say that the plan that's been put out there,
Healthy Pennsylvania,
in terms of what it does for current Medicaid, is going to shift a lot of people off of Medicaid and reduce the cost of it, but probably doesn't improve the quality of Medicaid for those who are on it.
Do you agree with that, Judith?
Well, I think it's important to understand that most Medicaid beneficiaries, and I think this is the case in Pennsylvania as in the entire country, actually are enrolled in private health plans, the managed care plans that participate in the Medicaid program. So, the private-public kind of distinction is not all that meaningful.
You know what? Hold on to that thought. I'm sorry to do that to you, Judith, only because we do have to take a very short break. That's Judith Solomon. She's Vice President for Health Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Also with us, Nathan Benefield, and he's Director of Policy Analysis for the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives. And the policy that we are talking about is the Healthy Pennsylvania plan that Governor Corbett announced late last year. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra presents Cirque de la Symphonie. Aerial acrobats literally drop into the Kimmel Center, each gravity-defying feat choreographed to music. Acrobats, contortionists, dancers, jugglers, all this and more, performing to music above and around the orchestra. Cirque de la Symphonie. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. This Friday and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, the Philadelphia Orchestra presents Cirque de la Symphonie.
Few reporters know Washington like NPR's Cokie Roberts. Hi, I'm Dave Davies, inviting you to join me for a timely and in-depth discussion I'll be hosting with Cokie at the Merriam Theater Thursday, January 23rd. Call 1-888-345-9499 and make a $10 a month sustaining membership gift to WHYY. We'll send you two tickets to this event as our way of saying thanks. Again, that's 1-888-345-9499 to make your sustaining contribution and reserve your seats now. Thanks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, the EU lifts employment restrictions on its two poorest member states. How many Romanians and Bulgarians will cross borders looking for work?
this is not the same situation as a decade ago when so many hundreds of thousands actually left from Poland and other Eastern European countries.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Motz-Cohen, talking with Judith Solomon and Nathan Benefield about Governor Corbett's plan to essentially privatize Medicaid, intended to bring health care to about 500,000 uninsured Pennsylvanians. And just heard from Alana Gordon, one of our reporters here at WHYY, and the hearing is on for tomorrow. It's at the Constitution Center here in Philadelphia, and it's going to be a chance to, I guess, testify and hear more about this program, and it apparently is going to be running from 10 until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. We are talking about this on the radio and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet me at Marty Moss Cohen. Judith, you wanted to say something right before the break. Do you remember what it was?
Well, I was talking about the fact that most people get their coverage through private plans. I mean, the other thing that I think is important on the skin in the game point is that there is flexibility in the program, and you can have co-payments for services for people below the poverty line. And in both the demonstration projects approved for Iowa and just the other day for Michigan, they actually are saying that people who engage in so-called health behaviors, meaning that they go and they get a risk assessment, they get their regular checkups, have an opportunity to have those co-payments reduced or waived. And that's, you know, a way to get at this notion that people need to have some skin in the game and some incentives to engage in healthy behaviors. But I think the barriers have been now being uninsured, and I think many people will jump at the chance of being able to get a checkup once they're enrolled in Medicaid.
So it sounds like you're more in support of the idea of co-pays and using co-pays as an incentive for folks?
Well, I mean, if you're going to have a proposal that has to have incentives, right, then I think that is the way to go, and that's the way that's authorized under the Medicaid statute. Again, you know, we're talking about a program that has rules. Some of those rules can be waived. But, you know, so far there is a pretty hard line that's been drawn about premiums that result in people losing coverage when their income is below the poverty line. So I think the real goal going forward is to come up with a proposal for Pennsylvania that meets the statute and also can get at some of the things that the administration wants to do. And I think the negotiations in both Iowa and Michigan have shown a pathway to get there.
Nathan, let me put something else to you. And this we're focused on premiums, but that seems to be such an important part of this proposal. If you miss three payments in a row, your coverage is stopped, is terminated.
Well, I think that's the – I mean, if you're having a premium, you have to have a point at which you're going to, you know, require the payment and have a cancellation. So I think it just goes to the debate of whether you should have premiums or should be providing this coverage for free or not.
But if you're a low-income worker, and I think generally speaking, low-income workers, not only are they low-income, but oftentimes they run out of money. You know, they can't necessarily make it from month to month. So there might be a period where they're still working and still trying to pay their bills, but they literally don't have enough money.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when you talk about, you know, this, and it's often pointed as the trade-offs. From, you know, they have to cut back somewhere else. You really need to look at the overall benefit package that a person at that income level can get, including, you know, housing support, including food stamps, including other welfare benefits. Because the, you know, the income levels are set, but it's only based on wages and salary there. And there are a number of other programs to help them support them in you know, the most needy in our society.
Enough so that they're not poor?
Not so much that they're not poor, but certainly I think you need to consider, you know, when talking about, use the income levels, the thresholds that are put out there, you have to also look at the other benefits that are available to people in that income bracket, because the income kind of understates the overall benefits that are available to them.
Judith, do you agree? Disagree?
Well, certainly the housing programs are far, far more scarce than to cover everyone. So, you know, most people are having to pay the full cost of their housing. It's true that there is the benefit, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, now formerly called SNAP, not formerly called food stamps, is available. But again, if you tried to live on, you know, 50% of the poverty line or 75% of the poverty line, I think you would find that this even $13 a month would be a heavy lift. And at some point, you know, whether it's the car that gets you to work breaks down, or, you know, someone gets sick who in your family who doesn't have coverage, you're going to have a hard time paying that premium.
Would it be fair to say, I'll put this to you, Nathan, then to you, Judith, would it be fair to say that Medicaid recipients or low-income individuals have more health problems than the rest of the population, or are a bigger user of the system, Nathan?
Well, there's different Medicaid populations. So a lot of Medicaid benefits go to disabled as well as seniors. We're certainly going to have higher needs and higher costs, and that's a large segment of the Medicaid population is those higher needs of the current program, and as well as, you know, higher eligibility for children, who actually probably use it a little bit less, and then the very, very low-income adults. There is probably overall a greater usage, but it's very different within those populations. The expansion population we're talking about is largely going to be able-bodied, childless adults that we're looking at, the low-income populations.
But how do you see this? How do you see them using the system, Judith?
Well, I mean, I think that's right. I think the newly eligible population in the aggregate is actually a healthy population, although there are certainly subpopulations within there of homeless people and people with mental health and substance abuse problems, which is, you know, one of the reasons many states have said that they actually want to move forward with coverage, because we've seen the benefit of being able to support people with serious mental illness, substance abuse problems, who often end up in other parts of the system that funded by the state-funded mental health and substance abuse programs. Many people end up in jails, so we've seen certainly a lot of support for expansion among sheriffs and county officials who are picking up the cost of people who end up in jail, who really don't belong there, and they're there because of the lack of mental health treatment. So within the population, which is a generally healthy population, there's a population of very vulnerable, high-needs people who definitely would not have the wherewithal to pay the $13 a month in premiums.
We have an email from Ann asking, don't all of these requirements add administrative costs to Medicaid? Wouldn't it be simpler and more cost-effective to leave out all these hurdles to getting care? And I'll toss that first to you, Nathan.
There certainly will be some administrative costs, you know, to administer and to do, you know, some of those checks and, you know, collect the premiums and stuff. In terms of the broader, you know, size of the Medicaid program, those administrative costs are going to be de minimis in terms of how much we're spending on Medicaid. And you know, the cost of the program, you know, the already existing costs of administering it with, you know, Department of Public Welfare as being one of our largest staffed agencies within the state. So there would be some additional administrative costs, but they would be small compared to the overall cost of the program and the potential savings from some of these changes.
How do you see that, Judith?
Well, I think there would be administrative costs to track income and come up with the right premiums. But the bigger thing is that, you know, the savings really come from the lack of participation. And right now we would be talking about savings to the federal government, because we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the lion's share of the costs are of the newly eligible population will be paid by the federal government, not the state of Pennsylvania.
Well, we are talking about Governor Tom Corbett's plan to overhaul the state's Medicaid system using federal money for subsidies through the private health care market. It's called Healthy Pennsylvania. He's added work requirements, premiums for some low-income recipients. We're talking about the potential impact. Will the federal government give him a green light on this proposal? And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Judith Solomon, Vice President for Health Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and Nathan Benefield, Director of Policy Analysis for the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives. And again, his organization located in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Judith's organization in Washington, D.C. Let me see what Allison from West Philadelphia has to say. Allison, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I am one of those low-income individuals, and thankfully I make just enough to be in the Obamacare subsidy, so now I get to pay nothing a month for my health care, which is amazing, because I used to pay a third of my income. But the thing that I have experienced is that it's not just a cost issue. Like, I may be able to scrounge up $13 from somewhere, but getting a bill paid every month on time is really hard when you are broke, because you have a lot more of a chaotic life than Nathan Benefield probably experiences. And when you're broke, you don't have bill auto pay to just auto debit your money from your bank account, because you don't have, either you don't have a bank account or you don't have enough money to be consistent about it. Mm-hmm. So that creates a barrier, just not even in terms of the money, but in terms of the, like, functionality of your life, which is very chaotic when you're broke. And for...
Well, you know what, Allison? Yeah, hold on to that thought. Let me give Nathan Benefield the chance to respond.
Well, I think certainly I understand the concerns and the difficulty with paying bills, especially when you're in that lowest income and don't have especially those who don't even have a steady stream of income to pay it off. Certainly understanding of those difficulties, and think that, you know, perhaps we can look, you know, in terms of the governor's proposal of having the cutoff at 3 months, whether that's, you know, the timing of that is appropriate or not.
And the way it stands now, after 3 months, your coverage essentially would be cut off.
Yeah.
Assuming it's passed.
Correct. And so I think there's room to look at that and adjust that. Certainly, it doesn't make sense to have a premium requirement if you aren't actually required to pay it, and you can go, you know, without paying your premium and never be cut off. So I think, you know, just logically, you know, it there has to be at some point a cutoff, whether it's 3 months or longer, because of the disadvantage of those people paying. I would say that, you know, this is a broader, you know, Allison raised the question of those who are in those low income brackets, and you know, the very poor in our society have problems paying their bills regularly and getting in the habit of that. That is a really a major issue for a lot of those people. And you know, in past work, I actually looked at some of the housing reform things, and a lot of things we saw in housing reform in the 90s and early 2000s was shifting people from public housing to private housing through voucher programs. But a lot of those people weren't used to paying bills, weren't used to paying utility bills, electric bills, and stuff like that. But I think that, you know, a very disadvantage for them, they're not used to kind of being able to transition to being independent, and I think that is a major issue and major concern for them, and they need to try and help them learn to adjust to that lifestyle.
And Judith, hold on to your thought. Allison, you wanted to add one more thing. Are you still there? No, I think we lost her. I appreciate, though, the call to Radio Times, and Judith, it sounds like you want to add something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think she made a very, very important point about the, you know, the difficulty, particularly the fact that so many people are unbanked, as we say. So I don't think, you know, it is, as Nathan said, is that, you know, they just don't know how to do things or pay their bills. I think that's a pretty paternalistic view. I think it is the barriers to having a bank account, to having to pay for money orders, and having those competing interests. And again, I think we always have to fall back on the fact that we have research that shows that if we really want to get people coverage, premiums get in the way and they lower participation. And if we want to get coverage to the people with serious mental health issues, substance abuse, to, you know, take some of the burdens off of counties and localities that are supporting them, as well as to help those people recover, it just doesn't make sense to have premiums. And in some ways, this debate is not even relevant, because we know that a proposal for premiums at 50% of the poverty line that results in people being cut off is not going to be approved. We know that from the Iowa experience. The governor really wanted that, and the final proposal does not allow that. There will be monthly payments, small monthly payments. We haven't seen the final proposal, but they're certainly less than $13 a month, but they're not going to result in people being cut off coverage. That's just not, I think, negotiable at this point.
And as I understand it, Nathan, the law is that there can be no premium if someone's income is 1.5 times the poverty level. And according to the way Healthy Pennsylvania is today, it's less than that.
Right. I mean, the current plan, the waiver plan,
yes,
require premiums. Required basically a waiver, and there's actually number in the proposals. Actually, a number of waivers are asking the federal government to approve, both for current Medicaid enrollees as well as for the newly eligible population that they want to enroll in the exchange, and they want waivers to both sides of it. And I tend to agree with part of Judith what she was saying. The federal government has not indicated a flexibility to approve all of those things, and what Pennsylvania is asking for is much broader than what Iowa asked for.
So chances are it's not going to pass muster.
Well, the question is how much of it are they able to get? And there's going to be probably a lot of negotiations between the federal government and the state government over the next few months. And the question is how much is the federal government willing to accept, and how much is the state willing to take or drop before they actually just walk away and say we're not willing to even consider this.
Let me get to Laura from looks like Bethlehem to join us. And Laura, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
There's a couple things that I really really wanted to say about this.
Let's do one. Okay.
Just one.
Okay. Go ahead.
Just one. Because we have such a large portion of rural hospitals here in Pennsylvania that are currently getting federal money for uninsured patients for charity care.
Right.
As that money disappears, if we do not provide paying patients who have coverage, how are our hospitals going to stay open, and how are we going to be able to provide care in rural areas here in Pennsylvania? I'm not sure how that's going to work.
Well, Laura, that's a very good question. And Judith, I know you're down in D.C., but I'd be curious about your response to Laura's concern.
Well, let me just give a little more context for what is a very legitimate concern that she has. Before the Supreme Court decided that the Medicaid expansion was essentially a state option, the notion was that the need for those payments for uncompensated care would go down as more people had Medicaid. And so in the law, there are reductions that grow over time and eventually become fairly substantial in those payments. If a state doesn't expand Medicaid, then the hospitals are not going to have, as she said, a lot more paying customers, and they're going to suffer. And that's why, in most states, you've seen strong support from hospitals for expanding Medicaid, because, again, that was the premise of the law. So her point is very well taken.
Nathan, about 30 seconds before the break, your response.
Sure. Well, certainly the hospital lobby has been one of the most aggressive groups really pushing for Medicaid expansion because they want, additional federal dollars to flow to them. But one thing you have to really look at is states that expanded Medicaid in the past. Oregon did this before the Affordable Care Act in the 2000s, actually did not reduce their uncompensated care or charity care at all. In fact, saw that number of uninsured increase there.
So you're saying, well, we don't know, or it may turn out better than what our caller was concerned about?
Well, I think Medicaid expansion is not going to solve that problem. And, in fact, there's a lot of cost shifting from Medicaid to private coverage.
And that's Nathan Benefield, Director of Policy Analysis for the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives, located in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Also with us, Judith Solomon, Vice President for Health Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, located in Washington, D.C., We are talking about Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett's plan to overhaul the state's health system for low-income residents. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Next time on The Pulse, the impact of concussions.
There's been hits where I've seen stars.
Your brain got hit.
Your brain got hit. Your brain got hit.
Guidelines for athletes.
You seeing stars, get out of the game. Do not play any further, period.
And reality.
It was the playoffs, so I was like, I got to help my team. I got to go back in.
I'm not going to lie. I threatened kids to tell me the truth. It was, hey, if you really screw this up, you could die.
The Pulse, tomorrow morning at 9 on WHYY.
Many Americans have been introduced to the world of British servants from TV series like Downton Abbey and Upstairs Downstairs. At the beginning of the 20th century, domestic service was the largest single occupation in Great Britain. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Lucy Lethbridge about her new book, Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Those New Year's resolutions, we're pretty good at making them, but even better at breaking them.
I made the same resolution I make every year.
To take charge of my health.
I unfortunately did not meet that goal.
How one family created a competition to motivate each other to keep those resolutions next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the fact that Pennsylvania was one of the states that opted out of the government expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett's Healthy Pennsylvania is his proposal to expand health insurance for the state's low-income residents using the private health care market. We've been talking about the fact that his plan requires some recipients to pay a premium for their insurance and that several mispayments would result in termination of coverage. There are also incentives for working and for healthy behavior. And again, talking with Judith Solomon and Nathan Benefield, and we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What do you make of the work requirement under this Healthy Pennsylvania, Nathan? And then I'll hear from you, Judith.
Yeah, well work requirements have worked in other programs, and most famously, you know, welfare reform of the 90s added work requirements for the program that's now known as TANF, requiring people to either able-bodied people, of course, being either working or looking for work or in a job training program, and that has been very successful at transitioning people from being on welfare into work. And that's really, you know, the best way to help the poor is to help them transition to a mm-hmm. job, especially one that you know, well-paying job and one that provides insurance. And so the need to have work requirements is because we want to help these people, but we want to help them move from being dependent on welfare to being independent and in a career.
But even in a very uncertain work marketplace as we have today?
Well, it's very difficult. That's why, you know, the requirements are not just, you know, working, but also looking for work, actively looking for work, and, you know, in job training programs. So it's beyond, you know, actually having a job, which may not, you know, be possible given the economy, but being actively seeking work opportunities.
How do you see this work aspect of a Healthy Pennsylvania, Judith?
Well, I think this is another one that we know will not be approved, and it's my understanding that the Corbett administration has been told that repeatedly. Work search requirements have never been allowed in the Medicaid program. They're allowed in the cash welfare program, but never been allowed as a condition of getting health coverage. Again, this is health coverage. We're in a situation now where we have subsidies going up to, you know, 400% of the poverty line. Nobody is being asked whether they're looking for work or not, and the, you know, the thing about these is that they're pretty harsh. I mean, they apply to everybody who's working less than 20 hours a week. So even somebody working, you know, 19 hours a week and getting by maybe doing other things, taking care of kids, is affected by these. And again, if you don't do what is required, which is at least, I think it's 12 activities in the course of a week, you get your coverage dropped, and this is just, again, it's a non-starter as far as I can see it.
Nathan, response, and we'll get back to our callers.
Well, I mean, I think it's a very reasonable expectation that those who are able to look for work do so, and. That, you know, it's an important step both for to protect the security of the program, but also to for those beneficiaries. And as to the latter part of whether it's, you know, something that the federal government will go along with, I think, you know, the Obama administration has been very opposed to any changes to the Medicaid program, and so I think that. Shouldn't be held against Governor Corbett's ideas of a way to actually fix the program. We actually need to push the Obama administration to be more flexible in what states can do and how they can administer this program rather than saying that federal inflexibility is a reason just to go along with whatever the federal government wants.
Judith, why, though, why de-link work and health insurance?
You know, it's just they're just really two different things, if you think about it. I mean, health insurance is insurance, protection from risk. It is not anything people get as cash income. You know, we're not asking people with incomes above the poverty line to do this, who can enroll in the exchanges, or you know, if Pennsylvania expanded above 133% of the poverty line. It's always been a part, or for a long time been a part, of the cash welfare system. But here we're talking about a lot of people who are working. You know, they're working in jobs without insurance, or they're unable to work for some reason. So it's just never been associated. The only time it's really been associated is that, you know, for parents who are getting cash assistance, and if they don't comply with the conditions of that program, states have the option of terminating their medical coverage. But that's as far as it goes. For the people who are not receiving cash assistance, which likely means they are getting by, they're working, maybe they're getting a Social Security benefit, maybe they're getting some other form of assistance from family or friends, we just have not associated that with protecting them from risk of health care, and the fact that we want people to get in for prevention and all those things, and not to create barriers for that. They're just really two very different things.
Let me read an email from, looks like Ali. How can benefit cuts be included in a plan that is supposed to improve access to care? I guess that's in your court there, Nathan. Go ahead.
Well, I would even question the premise of that question. That, you know, the Affordable Care Act, you know, is named, you know, about Affordable Care Act, but hasn't they made anything more affordable? And really isn't about care either. It's about you know, providing more, you know, insurance subsidies to buy health insurance to more people in Medicaid. That we're talking about provides through the exchanges, provides almost $1 trillion in subsidies to buy private insurance, and then a series of regulations on insurers, both employer provided and the private insurance market, which is why you know millions of people will be actually seeing their plans being canceled because of the regulations in the Affordable Care Act. It's really about insurance. It's not actually about providing affordable care or access to care.
Do you see it that way, Judith?
I'm not quite sure I actually really understand the point in the distinction. I see it as a way to get health coverage to protect large swaths of the population that haven't been able to get it. As you go up the income scale, we're talking more about people who have a pre-existing condition, or who are older, or, you know, have some history of a health condition and haven't been able to get coverage, or have only been able to get it at a very steep price. So the reforms in the insurance market are to, you know, create a pooling mechanism so that everybody can get in, and that, you know, women, for example, are not charged more than men just because of their gender, which is the case before yesterday when all the reforms kicked in.
Let me get Patrick from, looks like, Fishtown to join our conversation. Patrick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a certified application counselor and a volunteer certified application counselor, enrolling people in the new health insurance marketplace. And for those who are between 100 and 133% of the federal poverty line, which would otherwise make them Medicaid eligible, we've been able to, through the tax credits and the cost sharing, get them incredibly low premiums, often under $1 a month. And one of the hardest things, as we've had this influx of people applying and enrolling in healthcare, is that, you know, often their coworkers or, you know, family members who maybe are working, you know, just a few less hours, you know, are not eligible because Pennsylvania hasn't accepted the Medicaid expansion. And it's really a hard situation to be in, to tell individuals who haven't had healthcare often for, you know, years, if not decades, that, you know, someone who makes just a little above that can get a premium for, you know, 67 cents a month, and that, you know, they fall below, and we just can't do it. And I'm hearing all this talk about premiums, and it sounds like the governor's plan is really going to put a lot of people in a disadvantaged situation just because of the fact that they're making a little less than that 100% mark.
Patrick, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Judith, I'd be curious about your response.
Well, I think he said it in a nutshell, and we work a lot with certified application counselors and navigators all over the country, and we hear this again and again. I mean, they are in this very, very strange position of having to tell people basically, you're too poor to qualify. You know, in the past, it always was, well, you make too much money, you can't have this program. But now we're basically telling people that they don't make enough. And that, you know, as he said, your coworker may have, you know, someone else in the family who's working to bring them above the line and be able to qualify. But we're really in this, you know, really horrible situation for 281,000 Pennsylvanians who are in the coverage gap.
What do you think, Nathan?
Well, I think, you know, the coverage gap is real and was created by the Affordable Care Act when it, especially when the Supreme Court ruled the federal government couldn't mandate states participate in Medicaid expansion, and so kind of the people who are eligible for subsidies in the exchange would be a higher income, and then the Medicaid expansion population would be the lower income. One thing to note is that, you know, when Congress debated the Affordable Care Act, they talked about, you know, basically having everyone you know, newly eligible be eligible for the exchange subsidies rather than the Medicaid expansion, and they actually rejected that because estimates would be that would cost more than the Medicaid expansion alone. And so that's something to consider, you know, in Pennsylvania with the Healthy PA, as well as, you know, what Arkansas did, that it probably will end up costing more per person than you know, traditional expansion of Medicaid.
Mm. You think so, Judith?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that the coverage in the exchange is going to be more expensive than, you know, Medicaid, which is a fairly lean program with low administrative costs. And, you know, the lower costs really are, it's true, due to the fact that providers are paid less in Medicaid. But at the same time, you know, Nathan is saying the overall program costs too much. So, you know, it's sort of like we can't have it both ways. The notion in Arkansas was that having, you know, large numbers of people come into the Medicaid program, the provider capacity would not be enough. And that's sort of what they're testing out, is whether just having people go into the exchanges is going to actually bring down the cost of the coverage in the exchanges by having a larger pool. You know, that's what they're testing. Again, these are demonstration projects. They're designed to test something, and that's the test, is, you know, is in the overall, in the aggregate, is it going to cost less? And you know, we don't know that, but it is true on a per capita basis, it costs more for the coverage in the exchange than it would in Medicaid.
Let me see what Susan from Reading has to say. Susan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I think, first of all, the Affordable Care Act is a good thing. It needs a lot of tweaking, but it's a good thing, you know, because there's a lot of us out here that are just above, just like he was talking about, that you don't have coverage. And the thing that got me to call was when he was talking about us being so disheveled that we can't manage our finances. That is so wrong. There are some, that's true, that's the case. But there's some like me that are intelligent, able to make decisions, and our decision is, do we pay health care or do we have an apartment? You know, sometimes there's just not enough to go around. And the thought of being on the whole out on the street as opposed to not having health care, I'm choosing my apartment.
I hear you, Susan. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Nathan, obviously, that's directed to you. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I feel for the caller who has to struggle with that and understand, you know, the issues with you know, being able to afford both. I would, you know, point to the larger question, though, is whether the Affordable Care Act actually makes health insurance more affordable for everyone, and whether it provides greater access to care. And I would suggest that it does not, and there are actually better ways to solve those issues.
And what are those better ways?
Well, I mean, I would point to you know, if you look at when states actually had flexibility on Medicaid and were getting waivers, the Florida model that got a waiver from Medicaid and redesigned the entire program, making it based on premium assistance for low-income populations, allowing people to choose among different plans, and provide incentives for healthy behavior. And you look at that model, it was only implemented in about, I think, six counties in Florida. But those actually ended up costing less per person, but also got better health outcomes and better satisfaction from participants. And so I would look at that as a model for how we actually fix Medicaid if the federal government would give Pennsylvania the flexibility we actually need.
Is that a model that you know, Judith?
Well, it really is what the Florida model was managed care. And, you know, Pennsylvania has managed care for Medicaid beneficiaries. So it really wasn't that different. It did provide some incentives for people for certain behaviors, but it really was not that radically mm-hmm. different than what states are doing now. So I really don't. It's sort of surprising to me that that's what, you know, he's pointing to, because it really is not that different. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think we always have to be in the place of thinking that, you know, these are demonstrations and, you know, what are we demonstrating? And you can't sort of run roughshod over the structure of the program just to decide that we want to, you know, do these things differently. And there is, at the same time, a lot of flexibility in terms of, you know, things like cost sharing, use of private managed care plans. All those things can be done. So, you know, my hope would be that there is some middle ground, that they can reach agreement, knowing, again, that the work search and the, you know, the enforceable premiums for people below the poverty line are not going to be mm-hmm. allowable. They are allowing premiums for people above the poverty line.
Well, we're almost out of time here. Nathan, do you think this plan, the Corbett plan, is going to get the waivers it's requesting from HHS, the Obama administration?
Well, I would be very surprised if they got everything they asked for. This is a very, you know, very robust plan. You know, it's a I don't know how many pages, you know, 80 pages plus of a proposal that's going to the federal government after this round of hearings. And, you know, the Obama administration has not shown a lot of flexibility when they dealt with you know, other states. So I would be very surprised if they get, you know, even the lion's share of this proposal approved.
What do you think, Judith?
Well, I think I don't know what you talk about as the lion's share. I mean, I think there's certainly features of it that are not going to be approved. But the overall goal of expanding the program is something that I think they are, you know, really waiting to do. They would really they've been flexible with states to get to yes. I mean, I think that has been the goal overall in states like Michigan, who's, you know, just got approved, in Iowa and Arkansas.
And that's Judith Solomon. Thank you for joining us today, Radio Times.
Thank you.
And she's Vice President for Health Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Nathan Benefield, thank you very much as well.
Thanks for having me.
And he's Director of Policy Analysis for the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives. And again, there is a hearing tomorrow at the National Constitution Center on Healthy Pennsylvania. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, and stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.